The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from teenvogue.com and kidspiritonline.com. Our first article today from teenvogue.com. Politicizing transgender athletes is dangerous. Leah Smith deserved better. This article was written by Caitlin Burns on November 7th, and there is a note. In this op-ed, writer Caitlin Burns discusses the death of Leah Smith and calls for dignity and justice against the hostility that transgender athletes like her face on a daily basis. By all accounts, Leah Smith was someone we should look up to, an athlete and a leader who sought to change the world for the better for her community. She was active in her Middlebury College campus, speaking out against what she saw as injustice. I never got the chance to meet her, but isn't that the type of person many of us aspire to be? There was one small issue for Leah that ended up defining her life, though. She was transgender. To be clear, the issue wasn't Leah's transness, but rather how the world today has decided to treat transgender women like her. Smith was found dead near campus on October 23rd. Officials have ruled her death as a suicide. As a freshman, Smith was on the Middlebury College women's swimming and diving team. But according to a report compiled by Ari Drennan, Smith experienced a lot of pressure because of her participation on the team, saying she felt awkward using the women's locker room. And according to the Addison County Independent, Smith also said she had to jump through hoops to participate on the team she was recruited for, struggling to get blood tests to prove her hormones were within limits set by the National Collegiate Athletic Association, NCAA, the organization overseeing Middlebury's sports programs. At one point, Smith said she took a break from the team, per reporting on a student event covered by the Addison Independent. In January, a social media account called He Cheated focused its attention on Smith, deadnaming the swimmer. The attention led to an online harassment campaign against her. It's really hard putting on the suit every day if you are obviously an outlier, Smith said during a panel on trans health care and politics at Middlebury earlier this year. Just for being a trans athlete, Smith faced harassment and adversity. But in February, the NCAA bowed to Trump administration pressure and banned trans women like Smith from playing on women's sports teams. This sparked even more frenzy about the inclusion of trans people in sports teams, leading to a renewed wave of harassment against athletes like her. Of course, trans people bore the brunt of that harassment, all while understanding that their right to exist authentically was again being legislated away. I want to be clear here. Banning Smith from playing on a team that she had already quit was likely not the reason she died by suicide. But it's long past time we have a serious societal conversation about how the politicized lives of trans people threaten the basic structures of life for us. Leah Smith was an athlete her whole life. I, too, was an athlete in high school and college. There's a certain rhythm of life you get used to and come to depend upon. Wake up, train, study, train some more, take care with your diet, get plenty of sleep, socialize with your teammates. Smith did not set the original NCAA policy that allowed trans participation in college sports, nor did she decide to turn it into a national outrage that a trans girl might find joy in a women's sport. Study after study has shown the positive physical and mental health impact that goes along with athletic participation. All of that was taken away from Smith. What was once a reliable, repeatable pillar of her life was ripped away from her, first because she felt like an outlier among her peers, and then because the powers that be took away her right to be on the team. As we look at how the Trump administration and conservatives at large have pursued their anti-trans agenda, they've consistently targeted the fundamental social pillars upholding trans lives. Last Thursday, NPR reported that the Trump administration was preparing to propose a new Department of Health and Human Services rule that would bar health care providers who provide gender-affirming care to youth from receiving Medicare and Medicaid funds. This is another pillar for trans people that is being undermined, our access to reliable and affirming health care. The Trump administration is also targeting funding for colleges and universities, unless they agree to undermine trans life on campus. Brown University is among several schools that agreed to bar trans people from using private facilities of their transitioned gender. Some red states have even barred schools from using students' names that do not match their birth names. That's pillar after pillar of basic life, basic respect, crumbling under the weight of Republican bigotry. Smith chafed under all of this, and by all reports, fought back, participating in on-campus protests for trans rights. When the college invited an anti-trans group to speak on campus, Smith protested it. But without a strong foundation, the weight of societal bigotry can become overwhelming. Smith is not even the first trans person to die by suicide at Middlebury in recent years. In 2023, another trans person died on campus. The college and the wider community should be looking into how they can better support their trans students. When we are constantly undermining trans life, no one should be surprised when things like this happen. There are some professional transphobes who have deluded themselves into thinking that there is no evidence that trans people do anything more than threaten to take their own lives to manipulate others into getting our way. Those of us on the ground who have trans friends, who are up all night making sure a trans friend having a mental crisis is able to work their way through it, know the truth. Transgender people are more than just a political issue, and we're in danger. We need all the help we can get from friends, neighbors, politicians, and school administrators. It's impossible to know exactly why Leah Smith died, but we do know the overall societal atmosphere in which it happened, and it's a hostile one in which trans people are increasingly discriminated against, excluded, and treated without respect or dignity. Let her passing be an inflection point for how you think about trans rights and trans people more generally. Help us. Our next article from KidSpiritOnline.com. Are we responsible for the consequences of our actions? This article was written by Finnegan Kelly on September 8th. I have been raised in the United States. Most people here grew up in an Abrahamic religious context, as most, if not all, have at least heard of the story of the Bible, which espouses the idea of free will, the idea that our choices are up to us and generally not in the control of external forces. We are also quite the individualist nation, as I'm sure you've heard 1,000 times by now, which has led many to believe themselves the singular driver of all of their decisions. Due to these factors, most Americans think they are responsible for pretty much all of what they do, the repercussions that come with their actions. Perhaps it speaks to some human want, or even need, to feel in control, to feel that no matter what happens, the roll of the dice was up to us, and that no one was fudging with the numbers. I, too, grew up believing this. I attended a Christian school from pre-K to 8th grade, and it was hammered into my mind that because God gave us the ability to do what we want, whenever we want, I, in turn, carried all of the responsibility for the consequences of my actions. A sort of deal. Believing in such an idea is not inherently bad or harmful. Thinking that I must account for every action of mine led me to try to better myself and avoid deeds that would harm others, and probably made me much more sympathetic than I would have been without these preconceived notions informing my every decision. Believing in free will leads people to think that we are the only ones in control of our destinies, that we alone reap the consequences of our actions. However, I find this chassis to not cover every corner of human interaction, and it has a few notable blind spots, including, but not limited to, peer pressure. Peer pressure is very common in everyday life and leads us to push ourselves to do many things that we otherwise would not have done. Try this on for size. Your friends are all doing wheelies in a parking lot with their sick new rides, having a great time, and one of your closest friends, Chet, asks you to join them right before they do their most daring trick yet and ride off a ramp, over a car, Evel Knievel style. You know that they may seriously hurt themselves and others if they do, but everyone joins in and tells you to do it with them, or else you are a wuss. What do you do? Not to speak for everyone, but it would be a hard choice for me to make. If you don't join in and everyone ends up all right, you are missing out on a valuable bonding moment between you and your friends. If you do, you may hurt bystanders, damage a stranger's car, or worse. This is a situation in which it is unclear whether we share the whole responsibility for the consequences of our actions or not. If it were solely up to you, I bet that you would not ride your bike off a ramp. But given the extra variables of your friends and their words of encouragement, you very well may. Situations such as these cast doubt on the notion that we are the sole inheritors of the consequences of our actions and shoulder all of the responsibility, and instead suggest that the picture is much larger and that responsibility is spread between all parties involved. You may rebuke the previous example I gave and say, okay, we can establish that life is too complex for there to be one sole recipient of responsibility. But what if you did not know that this was a stranger's car they were jumping over? Or that it would be possible to hurt yourself or others? In other words, what if we don't know the possible consequences of our actions? Are we still responsible? One way to respond to this is by looking at how we treat involuntary manslaughter. Involuntary manslaughter, as in causing the accidental death of another human, is a case in which it is unclear if one truly has a stake in the ramifications of what they have done. If you unintentionally put your foot on the gas instead of the brake and hit a person, or if your car malfunctioned, lurched forward, and hit them, would you be responsible? In the latter example, is the car manufacturer responsible for the faulty product? Are you both? Are neither of you? It is clear that both nature and human mistake, both factors outside of our control, led to this event taking place. But then, what do we do with the accidental perpetrator? Can we just let them go and seek no justice for the party killed? Most countries still punish those who commit accidental crimes. So is it fair to say they are responsible despite the fact it was not purposeful? It is impossible to say with certainty whether one answer is correct. I would argue that it is impossible to say if one should be made responsible for an accidental act, but I would lean toward no party being punished as to minimize damage. Your response may be the same or entirely different. As humans, we were not born with a sense of morality or justice. Instead, the idea of what these concepts should look like were planted and molded within by those who raised and had influence over us, alongside real-life experiences. Thus, our senses of morality and who shares responsibility vary. In my own opinion, our share of the responsibility for any action varies depending on the context. To tie back to my previous example on accidental manslaughter, you would share little blame, as unintentionally putting your foot on the gas is something that happens, human error. To say that one is responsible for an action without the intent to commit it is an antithetical to the human experience. And if anyone has lived, they will know this to be true. When one is peer pressured, however, I believe it to be less clear, as there are so many variables at play, such as your relationships with those involved, and if you are simply using peer pressure as an excuse to do what you already intended on doing. Overall, it is unclear how much of our actions are our responsibility, but I believe that we can divide our blame based on how much power we have to leave a situation, our intent to commit an act, and our knowledge of what will come as a result of it. Our next article from KidSpiritOnline.com, Back to the Future. Everything can change. This article was written by Joshua Deng on September 8th. Back to the Future. Director Robert Zemeckis, Universal Pictures, 1985. Running time 116 minutes. Rating 4.5 stars. If you put your mind to it, you can accomplish anything. Doc Brown, Back to the Future. As I watched Back to the Future, directed by Robert Zemeckis, for the first time as a 10-year-old child, I remember being curled up on the couch, lights off, and eyes glued right on the television. Laughing at the many corny, yet endearing jokes, I remember being so incredibly frustrated with the cliffhanger ending that I begged my parents to put on the sequel at that instant, enamored with this strange yet intriguing concept of time travel. Now, as a teenager, such questions on time travel remain persistent in my mind while the ending credits roll once more. How could I ever stop my bothersome sister's birth? Just a joke, sis. What would it be like to meet my parents when they were younger? Would the same person be president if I threw a rock at the window of the White House during the 1960s? As well as the very notion of time travel and the resulting butterfly effect, other aspects of the movie stuck with my thoroughly awed self. The dramatically vigorous orchestral score by Alan Silvestri remains memorable and enhances various scenes, including action sequences that are visually spectacular, as well as sweet sequences of character bonding. Every single line of dialogue and every prop is intentionally placed. But most importantly, and surprisingly for such an outdated film, the characters are what I'm drawn to. All the characters are distinctively unique and popping with personality. They all have understandable motivations for their actions in a way that is amazingly charming for an apparently shallow movie. Inherently, this timeless classic, with its dynamic pacing and hilarious humor, deserves 4.5 stars. Just missing on the several outdated aspects of the 80s movie. These aspects include visual effects, a somewhat incestuous off-color gag, and a lack of a deeper analysis of emotions. The film can still be enjoyed by all ages, but would be more suitable for a primary and middle school audience of around 11 to 15 years old. The story, set in 1985, centers on high schooler Marty McFly, who aspires to become a rock musician. Marty is portrayed as confident and ambitious, willing to take risks and explore. Unlike his family members, especially his meek father, George McFly. However, after a mishap involving a time machine made from a DeLorean, the eccentric scientist Doc Brown, a close friend of Marty's, and Libyan terrorists, Marty is plunged back 30 years into 1955 with no way of returning to the present. Additionally, Marty's interference with his parents' first encounter leads to a ripple effect, where his own existence is at risk of disappearing, forcing him to correct the past. Back to the Future presents a theory commonly known as the butterfly effect, where a small, trivial event in the past may result in much larger, unintended consequences in the future, for better or worse. This theory underlies the movie, both as the driving force of the film, where Marty is at risk of disappearing due to his actions, as well as in character development, particularly the younger George McFly. Between the 1985 before and the 1985 after, George undergoes a character arc from a meek victim to a more confident and heroic figure. So, what caused such damage? While some may argue that it was all due to Marty's influence, I say that it was also partly George's resolution and choices. Consider a ripple on water. Where the initial waves are caused by one factor, the ripple consists of multiple waves, choices, influences, resolution. These later ripples are all controlled by Marty's father, led by his own choices, thus creating a new man. The film's popularity can also be attributed to the brilliant acting by the impeccable cast. The main duo of Christopher Lloyd as the eccentric Doc Brown and Michael J. Fox as the charismatic Marty McFly are a comedy fest, executing the script's brilliant dialogue seamlessly and keeping the viewer hooked. Viewers have criticized the film in its display of time travel, picking at the plausibility and the several flaws in logic, yet I would argue that they have missed the whole point of the movie. The film sucks in the audience with its intriguing ideas involving the time continuum, only to keep the audience questioning as it progresses to the true message underlying the entire film. Personally, one of the reasons why I feel that Back to the Future remains a timeless classic is because of its uniquely conveyed message on change. Small changes over time can have significant future consequences, yet one can still shape their own destiny, demonstrated by George's growth. Even if you are not in the past, like Marty, choices in the present can shape your own future, although they may seem insignificant in the moment. While fate seems inevitable, all young people are faced with pivotal choices, and by taking control of life's obstacles, they can choose their dreams. This resonated with me the most as a young teenager experiencing the wonders of life. Thus, I advise you to watch Back to the Future, as it will be rippling through your mind as an everlasting and exciting watch. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.